Matt Rothschild here. I'm subbing in for Maggie Dawn. Maggie's a little bit under the weather this afternoon, so I decided to accept her invitation to take the wheel here for a little bit. I hope she'll be back tomorrow. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. And for you longtime listeners, you know that Maggie has done, in the middle of doing, actually, an incredible project, Biden's Top 100, the 100 best things that Joe Biden has done for you and for me and the people of Wisconsin and the people of this country while being president of the United States. And this week she wants to shed a light on this question of health care. And so when I was tapped to come in for her, I scratched my head for a second to think who could talk about health care in Wisconsin. And the answer, even in my addled brain, came Robert Craig. Robert Craig is the executive director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin and is one of the best leaders in our progressive nonprofit sector here in Wisconsin. Robert Craig, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show.
Good to be with you. And for Civic Media listeners, I'm on Earl Ingram weekly, but Earl and I haven't talked about healthcare recently, so this is a good brush up. And I think it seems like everyone, Matt, is maybe it's because debate week is looking at issues in the presidential election.
So how would you assess how President Biden has done on the healthcare issue?
Well, his agenda on healthcare actually has been more limited than, say, on climate, where he's made the first major investments and major effort in American history to tackle what is an existential threat, runaway climate change. In healthcare, of course, he had the Affordable Care Act, which he was part of that administration, the Obama-Biden administration, to build on. And so he has reinforced that, protected it from repeal, and then built out some other things as well. So I guess let me build out like he has from the Affordable Care Act. There are subsidies, as people know, for people who do not get good insurance at work but aren't Medicare eligible. They're not a senior or not Medicaid eligible. Their incomes are low enough depending on their state. And of course, that's an issue in Wisconsin where they have to be lower. They're even lower here because we're one of the 10 states or not nine states now not to take Medicaid expansion. But for those people who buy insurance on their own, there are subsidies on the marketplace. And they were, one of the flaws in the original Affordable Care Act was they weren't generous enough. So a lot of people still couldn't afford their coverage or had to make choices between other basic needs just to afford the premiums, copays, and deductibles. And during the pandemic and the American Rescue Plan, President Biden both made the subsidies more generous and expanded them to more people. And he was able in the Inflation Reduction Act, which also has the major climate investments, to make that permanent. So right now, there is more eligibility for Obamacare, as it was called, than ever before, and it's more affordable. So that's an improvement in the previous policy, but that's really important because if you look at inflation, Matt, if you dig into inflation, people's biggest financial concern is the cost of healthcare, because you don't just have, gee, the eggs cost me $2 more than usual. It's more like thousands, tens of thousands of dollars unexpected, any major engagement with the healthcare system, because no one knows what's going to be the bill or what the insurance company is going to pay until after they get the service, after they do something like I just did. Matt, I had a detached retina and had eye surgery. Now we get to see how that comes out with insurance, right? That's always like a mystery for all Americans.
How are you doing on that? Was that a painful surgery?
It's actually not painful. They put you out. In other words, it's general anesthesia, but they make you get contraptions where you have to stare down for a week, which is quite the thing for 24 hours a day to have your head in a downward position.
Doesn't that hurt your neck? Doesn't your neck get sore?
I had three different machines I could use, so I would switch between them. But it's pretty grueling, and you can put a little book underneath it. I bought a better tablet computer so I could look at that, at least look at videos. They give you a mirror so you can see the television, even though your head is down. Very strange apparatus. But anyway, that's quite an ordeal. I'm through that, so I'm on the mend. But Now, of course, we'll see what the Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield makes of this. You know how that goes. So that's huge, what he's done on the Affordable Care Act, President Biden. He also made major foray in terms of prescription drug prices. I think everyone knows that one of the, in fact, Matt, as you know, you did Clean Government and Money in Politics. You're aware, even though you worked more at the state level, of the corrupt deal that was made in the W. Bush administration with Medicare Part D, where the federal government was forbidden from negotiating for prescription drug prices. So we, the taxpayers, are paying a massive amount to cover prescription drugs as a benefit, but they get to charge whatever they want, even though we usually did the research to research the drug, then we hand over monopoly to a big pharmaceutical company, and then they charge what the market will bear. Wall Street says, if you're making 50% profit, why not 75%? Why not 90%? And so on. And so President Biden has made the first advances against the supposedly impregnable big pharma lobby that had been undefeated in the century until then, both getting 20 drugs listed that the federal government will negotiate over with Medicare for the drug prices. It should be all of them, which he wants to do more. So that's what he means probably by finishing the job, and taking one of the more abusive monopoly practices by big pharma, insulin, a drug that's been around for decades, no advances in it, and yet diabetics who need it to be healthy can't afford it because of the price gouging, capping for Medicare the cost at $35 for insulin.
I mean, that's huge, Robert. And I think it doesn't get enough attention. I mean, most people either have someone who's diabetic in their family or know someone who's got diabetes. And the idea that they were just being gouged out of every last dollar that they own just to get their insulin should have outraged everybody. And the fact that Joe Biden put this $30 a month limit on it is just a huge savings for hundreds of thousands, millions of people probably.
Now, it only applied to Medicare. He tried, and the Democrats tried to make it apply to private insurance, but Republicans invoked the filibuster. That is part of Biden's plan for a next term, is to extend it. But diabetics, if you stay in your insulin regimen, then you can live a completely normal life. If not, you're vulnerable to horrendous health conditions that are not only damaging to you and painful, but which can reduce your life expectancy. So we have people where doctors and nurses are engaged in heroic care to intervene because they couldn't afford their insulin, or they skipped some insulin doses so they could pay the rent or they could pay for food. And this is just to enrich the Wall Street traded pharmaceutical companies. So that's huge that he took them on, because neither Democrats or Republicans have been willing to take them on since then or defeat them. And that was a huge fight. And extend to private insurance will be another battle royal if President Biden is able to get a second term.
I mean, the amazing thing is that the VA is able to bargain collectively for all the veterans on prescription drug prices and volume, but other agencies of the U.S. government, Medicare, can't do that. And that's insane. It doesn't make any sense.
The rest of the world does it, Matt. I mean, we pay the most prescription drug prices in the world, and we do by far the most research in the world with our taxpayer-funded money and our major universities and research institutions. And so think of it this way. We hand power, think about it in terms of power, over to pharma by giving them this monopoly, right? We hand away our power. Our big power is the federal government is a huge purchaser. So we're not going to use our power, but we're going to let you have all the price-setting power. I mean, it's literally like a negotiated surrender to companies who, starting in the 70s with Milton Friedman and his ilk, believe that the only purpose of a corporation is to maximize profit, period. It has no other ethical obligations whatsoever. So the only reason you would do that is if you wanted them to bilk your own constituents, which is what Congress and previous presidents have been doing for decades.
Yeah, so this is both an ideological thing with the Milton Friedman so-called free marketeers, and then a money and politics thing, because the pharmaceutical industry has so many lobbyists in Washington and spends so much money during election time to buy the best Congress money can buy.
Oh, and Congress is infested with pharmaceutical lobbyists. And if us in state legislature, if every time something might happen, which is very occasionally in state government, you know, may they buy every contract lobbyist in Madison that's right. available, right? And flood the halls with them. And so Biden is going to be given credit. He was a more traditional Democrat who has played the game for 40 years in the Senate, but he evolved and he was willing to take on, frankly, two of the biggest interests in Washington. And he was willing to take on fossil fuel and the big utilities with his breakthrough climate legislation and the Inflation Reduction Act. And he's been willing to take on big pharma. He's also been the most aggressive president. This is related to healthcare, so I'm not, I may seem like a stray or not, but he's been willing to take on antitrust. All the monopoly, anti-monopoly laws from the progressive era, the populist era, they're still on the books. This country, following Milton Friedman and Robert Bork and their ilk, simply stopped enforcing its own laws. Democratic, Republican presidents, Biden has started doing so again. And the reason that's important, and it's not on like the major lists, if you look up the lists of Biden's healthcare accomplishments, one of the things he's been doing, because he has put an effective system together to use every federal agency to take on the trust. One of the big drivers in healthcare costs is the huge creation of huge hospital chains, where every hospital chain is trying to find a way to get bigger, to increase its negotiating power and merging with another one. So in Wisconsin, Aurora merged with Advocate in Illinois, and then that group merged with another big one in North Carolina, Charlotte-based. ThetaCare and Freightert merged. Gunderson Lutheran in the western part of the state, and Baylin in the northeastern part of the state merged. So it's crazy. They're all merging. Mm. And they're doing that to get more bargaining leverage so they can get cheaper prices themselves and bargain better reimbursements from insurance. That's why insurance keeps conglomerating and growing. The Biden administration is going after those monopolies and challenging those combinations. That could really help with healthcare costs, is why I brought it up, man.
Well, thanks so much, Robert. Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action in Wisconsin. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Matt Rothschild, subbing for Maggie, who's ill today. We'll be right back.
Nobody knew that healthcare could be so complicated.
Hey, Matt Rothschild here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Maggie couldn't make it today because she was a little under the weather. I hope she'll be back tomorrow. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. With me for a few more seconds here is Robert Craig, the Executive Director of Citizen Action in Wisconsin. Robert, I wanted to ask you what your organization is doing or during this election time. Are you just a 501c3 and you can't say anything about the elections, or do you have the ability to get involved?
Oh, no, we're both a 501c3 and a 501c4. And so when we were founded 40 years ago, we're in our 40th anniversary year, we were revolutionary in a nonprofit that actually worked on elections and worked statewide. That was shocking in the early Reagan years. So we just, in fact, just went through our whole endorsement process for state legislative primaries. So we're extremely engaged in those races to try to elect people who are going to take on issues like healthcare and climate change. We have a very bold agenda on healthcare that we would like to see in now that we have fair maps, a very different legislature. So we have a bill that we've been working on for several cycles. Christina Shelton is the lead sponsor this year, Democrat from Green Bay, a Badger public option bill that doubles eligibility for Badger Care. It opens it up for anyone to buy in as an option on the ACE Affordable Care Act marketplace, or for small business and small employers generally to buy into. So that would have a huge impact on costs, because Medicaid, Badger Care set a fair price for healthcare and doesn't have the co-pays, deductibles, and claims denials of commercial health insurance, which is all part of their business model. So that bill, Matt, it had 44 co-sponsors in the last legislative session. So we've definitely taken the tack that the more co-sponsors we have, the more likely we are to pass it in a future session if we get more and more legislators to support it. We've also taken on the hospital consolidation issue. Hospitals got themselves deregulated in the 1980s under Tommy Thompson, and they have driven up prices. We have some of the highest prices for healthcare charged by hospitals in the country. We used to have a hospital rate review board. We want to restore that. Jeff Smith, the state senator from Western Wisconsin, is our champion on these. And they used to have to get approval for building new facilities to make sure they weren't simply doing duplication to compete with a competitor, but then were in essence making all both of them making us pay for unneeded facilities. All the building cranes you see, when you go into a city and see building cranes, you can pretty much guess it's going to be healthcare most of the time. And so we want to restore that accountability. And this was all driven by the crisis in the Chippewa Valley in Western Wisconsin, where one of the health systems was put out of business by its competitors. It was the one providing mental health coverage and more primary care, and it's ripped a hole in the healthcare delivery system and safety net in Eau Claire. And of course, the other big systems that survived, Mayo and Marshfield, are taking no responsibility. So we're going after the hospitals and the abuses of the insurance companies and trying to win elections and get people elected who will actually do that fight in Madison, just like we mentioned last segment, President Biden's been willing to and will continue to take on big pharma at the federal level.
And with fair maps, there's a good shot we can get a state assembly and state senate that can do that. So I want to urge everybody, as Robert Craig is, to vote in November and let's get stuff done here. Robert Craig's the executive.
On our website, you can volunteer with us. We have members all over the state. It's other people talking to each other that changes elections. Real grassroots democracy.
There you go. And how do people get hold of Citizen Action Wisconsin?
Just web search Citizen Action of Wisconsin.
There you go.
Our website will jump right up.
All right, Robert, thanks so much for being my guest today on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Great to see you, Matt. Great to talk to you. It's like the old days.
Oh, it's pleasure's all mine. And all of our listeners too. So here's a treat for our listeners. We got CJ on the line, and I've got a little secret. CJ and I actually had lunch together, a very civil, nice, friendly lunch in Middleton just last week. CJ, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call, Matt.
How you doing, my friend?
It was a good lunch. I am very well, thank you. And I had a great time.
Likewise.
I think we agree on a lot of things that I think kind of get hidden in the misinformation. And I guess that's one reason I call in, is that I want to defend what people claim that conservatives or megas or Trumpsters or whatever believe. And, you know, I've tried to get through to Dr. Kristen Riley many times to ask the question to her, Matt, and I appreciate you letting me through. Maggie doesn't always put me on either, but you're right, she does ask questions like a lawyer, tries to put you in a box.
She is a lawyer, but, though. That's her,
again, thank
that's
you
her training.
Exactly. She plays the role well on the radio.
Say, CJ, let me just go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to tell you what I believe most conservative Republicans believe, and I think President Trump believes, is the right for a woman to choose, but with restrictions. But there's also the exemptions of, I believe he would believe, in for the woman's health, the baby's health, or the rape and incest. But I think there should be a week. And what was the Dobbs? What was Roe versus Wade? How many weeks was that? Do you know, Matt? I know I'm a man, but I believe I've evolved on this issue like many people, I believe.
Well, I don't have it.
Because I am right to life, but I think women do have a right. And
yeah, But look, you know, so, but you're different. Let me just, CJ, let me just say a couple of things. One, number one, a lot of far right Republicans do not believe in the exceptions that you are articulating. In fact, the anti-abortion movement wants to ban abortion nationally, as we heard in the last conversation I had with Michelle Velasquez of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. The other thing that I wanted to say, CJ, and I want our listeners to know, is that, you know, you identify as MAGA sometimes, but when we were talking over lunch, you're really not MAGA in the sense that you don't believe, and I'm grateful for this, that January 6th was justifiable, was a good thing. And I think that's an important line, because there are so many people in the MAGA movement who are really in the MAGA movement who celebrate what happened on January 6th, the law breaking, the trashing, the violence, the vandalism.
No, not me. I think the ones that did damage or hurt police officers or did any kind of destructive, you know, activities there should be prosecuted. So that is not, I don't agree with it. And I think a lot of elected officials have stated so too. But you're right. I mean, I think there's so many misconceptions, and it's not fair of the media to put that, you know, to put misinformation. But you and I,
but Trump,
it was just you and I, we'd solve this stuff. No. I can tell you that.
Yeah, but Trump calls them political prisoners and patriots. So you got that. CJ, we got to run. I really appreciate talking with you again, and let's have lunch again. I'm looking forward to that. I got Jim Santel here in the studio coming back after the bump. Thanks for listening to the Maggie Dawn Show on Civic Media Radio Network.
You haven't got your health. You haven't got anything.
Here for the last half hour of the Maggie Dawn Show. Maggie's been under the weather today and asked me to substitute in, or at least Luke Mathers told me I should come up to the Waukesha studios and get behind the mic. And it's been a pleasure and honor always to be able to sub here for Maggie on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. I listen to Maggie every day. And another person I listen to is Jim Santel. Jim Santel is in the studio. He's a former federal prosecutor for many, many years, a lawyer here in Milwaukee. He sprinted over to the studio here after being in court this afternoon at about 1 o'clock or 1:30. And he is the host of a show on the Civic Media Radio Network on the weekends called Amicus, where he dives in for 2 hours on one of the most informative shows I listen to regularly, on all the legal comings and goings that affect our democracy, usually at the U.S. Supreme Court, but in also other courtrooms around the country. It's really an extremely valuable, informative show. So it's great to see you, Jim, and really appreciate the hospitality over here.
Matt, it is a pleasure and honor to be with you this afternoon. Always great to be in discussion with you about these major issues in America, including the United States Supreme Court and other courts out there.
Now, you've got some news about scheduling of decisions that are going to be announced at the high court. Tell me what you know.
So they've got 15 more decisions. That's a lot. They issued five before the 15 on Friday, so they can do it. But they scheduled Wednesday as an opinion release date. And it appears that also Thursday and Friday of this week, maybe on their docket as well. So it's entirely possible the Supreme Court may go out at the end of this week, having exhausted its docket, but issuing 15 cases in the next 3 days. And we got some really big ticket items, which I suspect your listeners are going to be interested in talking about. And they're going to be big. And these are the cases we've been waiting to hear from all term long.
And the biggest one for me anyway is the immunity case.
Absolutely.
Whether a president is restrained at all by the law while he or she is in office, or when he or she leaves office.
Right, man. You couldn't say it any better. It is stunning, as you and I have chatted in the past, even to believe that our highest court is entertaining seriously the prospect that a chief executive, our president, could in fact commit crimes while in the White House, in the Oval Office, and not be subject to the rule of law. Impunity, basically, is what they're talking about. Now, during the course of the oral argument on this one, it made it even muddier because a lot of them are suggesting that, well, maybe there's some distinction between the things that Donald Trump may have done in his personal capacity as president and things he may have done in his professional or official capacity. And maybe the lower court judge should kind of parse those two things out. That is almost as crazy as entertaining the overall notion that somehow a president is above the law. But we should, in fact, get that opinion very soon. And frankly, it's difficult to predict exactly what's going on. Highly unlikely that they're going to do what all of us anticipated, you and I included, that they would do, which is simply dismiss this concept as out of hand. No, of course, everyone is subject to the law. It appears that they're going to try to parse through some sort of middle ground here. And that is scary in and of itself.
So why is it so scary and so crazy? For instance, if the president, as commander in chief, tells the Pentagon or the 82nd Airborne, go attack this place in Afghanistan and kills an American who's over there, whether the person's on the enemy side or not.
Right.
And then should that family be able to sue the president of the United States?
And there are all kinds of situations. And believe it or not, under that particular scenario, which does happen routinely in our history, regrettably, there's something called the Federal Tort Claims Act. And believe it or not, you can't sue for things in a wartime environment. But that's not the issue. As your question indicates, what we're talking about here are crimes. What you just described is, again, based upon consultation with other people inside the Defense Department, inside the State Department. That's how presidents make those very tough decisions. We're talking about a president talking about maybe assassinating or going after a political rival, which Donald Trump has said he will do, doing other things. How about this scenario? President has the capacity to issue pardons, right? And that's virtually unfettered by any check and balance out there. What, Matt, if you and I approach a president and say, you know what, I need to have somebody pardoned. Here is $1 million to do it. Now, the conduct itself is official, right? Issuing the pardon. But plainly, the bribe is criminal. Can a president then get away with that by accepting a bribe to engage in that official kind of conduct? There are all kinds of instances like that. Yours is one of them. You just described other things out there. And it is so important to understand this concept just because it would quite literally put a president in the position of doing things once again without that kind of check and balance that we've had before. And at the risk of sounding like I'm engaging in huge hyperbole, an awful lot of people who are brighter than I am, know more about this than I do, have also said this is the beginning of the end of the republic. If you have a president who can remain in power, and which is another thing he could do, arguably, declare that elections are no longer going to be happening here. All of that is the beginning, arguably, of the end. And we hope that the Supreme Court is mindful of the consequences of what they're writing and probably sending to the printer right now.
That's why it was almost comical during the oral arguments when some of the conservative justices, especially Alito, were saying, well, I'm not interested in the facts of this particular case. I'm wondering what precedent we're setting for future generations or future presidents. Well, of course, they didn't want to look at the facts because the facts were as dramatic as you put them, a president who didn't want to leave office.
Exactly. And again, you can decide this case very narrowly and say, you know what? We don't have to adopt these large principles that are out there. We can simply say that these particular charges, there are four of them. We know what they are. They're specific. They're Jack Smith coming out of the indictment charges. We can simply say that as to these charges, there's no immunity. And leave larger questions for down the road. Maybe that's what they're pondering, but it certainly didn't appear that they were doing that during the oral argument, as you've just indicated. You've got people like Alito saying, well, wouldn't that encourage then people to stay in office because if they know they're going to be prosecuted by a future president down the road?
How ironic was that? Because this guy was trying to stay in office.
Exactly, right? And of course, that, as I've said in other settings, it shows such great cynicism about prosecution in America that you'd get people out there who would turn around and without any evidence, without a grand jury finding probable cause, would in fact find that a president is engaged in crimes when there is none at all. What Alito and others were saying that day was just ridiculous. And again, I will be fascinated and hopefully not horrified, as will the rest of the country, fascinated at least, by how the Supreme Court comes out on this. You also have Amy Coney Barrett saying, well, at a minimum, we should send this back. Let's send this back to the trial court. Well, that certainly means that there's no time soon when The judge who's presiding over this case is going to hear it. And again, even that task, what are you asking Judge Shutkin to figure out inside the evidence here? What's official? What's personal? What's not official? How do you do that, right? Absent a trial on the merits. And so all of this is confusing. It is upsetting. It is disturbing, potentially catastrophic for the nation if the Supreme Court goes down the invitation road that they have been invited to pursue here.
And what I was gathering from Alito was that he was suggesting, at least in his questioning, that he didn't think any president or former president should ever be able to be drawn into court.
Right.
And because he would say, well, who would want to be president then if you can be sued all the time?
Right,
well,
right.
I mean, it should come with the territory.
Absolutely. And there's a difference, too. Again, frankly, there are all kinds of cases, including on this docket, that have the name Trump and Biden in them from the time that they were president. Presidents get sued all the time, again, on legitimate bases and illegitimate bases. But they're civil cases. What we're talking about are not those cases in inside agencies. We're talking about bringing a criminal in prosecution from a grand jury based upon a finding that the president has personally committed crimes, individually committed crimes. That's a very different thing. And again, Alito kind of miseducates America on those circumstances under which presidents can and cannot be sued, even now.
And maybe I was reading too much into it, but it sounded to me like Alito was saying even state prosecutors shouldn't be able to do it. So he might issue a dissent that says these 34 felonies that Trump got convicted of are illegitimate.
Right, exactly. We know that there are people who are calling upon, including the Speaker of the House of Representatives, third in line to the presidency, Matt, as you well know, calling upon, figure this out, the Supreme Court to intervene and dismiss that state criminal conviction, the 34 counts. Boy, is that turning civics on its head. Again, I like to think that Mike Johnson knows better, and he's simply saying that for his own political purposes. But that kind of thing is not helpful in America. It's to the contrary. It's destructive. And it once again places in the Supreme Court, if you believe that theory, you shouldn't believe it, that they've got more power than they do. They do not have the authority to reach into a state court prosecution and overturn the legitimate decision of a jury of 12 people unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt. That just isn't not only our tradition. That's not civics in America for 245 years.
Well, we're going to see how far out on a limb a couple of these conservative justices are willing to walk.
Absolutely. And again, on all these cases, more and more, we talked briefly during the brief break here about Thomas, who is out there saying things like, you know, we should revisit these things. He's talked about revisiting recently the enforcement of Brown versus Board of Education. He's talked about maybe we went too far back in 1954 and 55. Oh, my goodness. He's talked about, of course, reversing privacy rights when it comes to contraceptives and same-sex marriage. Let's go back in time and revisit all these things. That also, thankfully, he's in the minority on those things, but this is how you begin to get that movement in that wrong direction.
I was struck by a scolding he got from Justice Amy Coney Barrett on this, because he was relying on tradition. And she said, well, you know, where in the law are you finding these precedents for tradition?
Right.
What statute has got tradition in it?
Right, exactly.
And so there's an interesting split appearing now among some of these conservative justices.
There is. And I think this may be the fascinating takeaway, regardless of these other high ticket cases coming out. This may be the interesting, fascinating break, the schism, if you will. It is beginning to be clear that at least you've got four. There happen to be all the women on the court, so good for them. And hopefully their voices will be heard more and more, saying that this notion that we look to the past and figure out whether there's an antecedent, a basis in history to justify present litigation. And the specific sparring that you're talking about, you've got it just right, Matt, came in the midst of this intellectual property case about a guy who wanted to trademark the phrase Trump too small. And again, you've got Clarence Thomas saying, well, in trademark tradition in history. And she said, wait a minute, where are you coming with that? Amy Coney Barrett goes all after him, paragraphs and paragraphs, saying this is crazy. Sonia Sotomayor, the others also take him to task on it. But we're seeing that more and more. And again, in this recent decision, just last Friday, this Rahimi case, the gun case, you also have a majority of, again, not a unanimous court, a majority once again saying, well, maybe we've gone too far. We can't, in that particular case, we cannot say that somebody who is subject to a domestic violence restraining order should have a gun in America. They decided that was a bridge too far. And along the way, some language, you have to read between the lines, from the Chief Justice saying, I think maybe we need to revisit some of this.
Thomas can even bring Alito along on that when he was left alone.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You mentioned the Chief, Chief Justice Roberts. What role is he playing here in trying to at least come to a majority that isn't paper thin?
Right.
I think it would be hard for him, as someone who's supposed to revere the institution of the U.S. Supreme Court, to come on the immunity case with a slender 5-4 partisan majority. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the Roberts Court. This is his history. We'll all look back on this years and years from now and say this is his legacy. He's got to be thinking about that, Matt. And so we think back again to 1954. The reason why Brown versus Board of Education was unanimous was because the Chief Justice at that time wanted it to be. He needed to speak with one voice about this important notion about race in America, that segregation cannot go on, that separate is inherently unequal. You'd like to think that John Roberts is also saying, we can't be the court. We can't be the court that goes in some opposite direction on this and other things.
That's Jim Santel. Jim Santel is the host of Amicus, a show here on the Civic Media Radio Network that you can listen to on the weekends. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm stepping in here for Maggie Dawn on the Maggie Dawn Show. Jim, you can hang out to
Absolutely.
The end of the hour.
Delighted
to. We got to dive a little more deeply into these Supreme Court decisions come down at the end of the week. We'll be right back.
Tell me that you love me. Yeah.
Tell me something good.
Tell me that you like it. Yeah.
If I become president someday, if I decide to do it, I will be looking at them very, very seriously for pardons. Very, very seriously.
Hey, Matt Rothschild. Still with you this afternoon on the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm subbing in for Maggie, who is a little under the weather today. I think she'll be back tomorrow. I sure hope she will. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network, and I'm joined till the top of the hour with Jim Santel, the great host of Amicus on the Civic Media Radio Network that plays on the weekends. I learned more from Jim's show about the law than I've learned since I was at the dinner table at home. My dad was a lawyer. So it's refreshing to talk with you.
That's very generous, Matt. I'm not a law school professor by no means, but we give it a shot.
There you go. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but I do want your predictions on this immunity case,
sure.
what the decision is going to be and what the vote is going to be, what
right.
the margin's going
right.
to be.
Right. So again, this is the kind of thing where you can hunt me down and say, see how wrong you were once again, Santel. So I will say this. I do not think they're going to issue the decision that as late as before the oral argument, I thought they were going to issue, which is just get out of our court. This is craziness. That's not going to happen. Very clear, I think, from the oral argument, unless there has been some real soul searching in the last few weeks, doesn't appear that that's going to happen. You're not going to get the clear, definitive statement. And so, I also don't think you're going to get what Donald Trump wants, which is complete immunity, right? And so someplace in between, and that, as I said before, that's almost as scary as the articulation of what Donald Trump does, in fact, want. I think what they're going to do is come up with some language. It's going to be messy. I don't think it's going to be clear. We're going to get at least three dissenters saying you must be joking. We know who those three are. Maybe more. Maybe you've got a Clarence, or not a Clarence Thomas, but others on the court who might push back on this. But my guess is that they will articulate some sort of never before heard from before differentiation between a president acting in an official capacity and acting in a personal capacity. I don't know how you parse those things out. I don't know how you define that. And again, during the course of his oral argument with him, this great person named Michael Dreeben, he's one of the deputy solicitors general arguing this case. And he said, and very diplomatically, What are you talking about, justices? How do you look at a crime and say, well, that piece was personal, and again, using the office of the presidency for personal purposes, but this one was official? How do you do that? Especially, again, as we talked before about these particular offenses, they're all meant to do one thing. They're personal in nature. They are meant to stay in power. So you shouldn't even have to go down that road. My guess is they're going to come up with some kind of strange articulation of this. Fascinated to hear how they try to define this. And they'll send it back down to Chutkan to figure this out. She is going to be throwing her hands up, I think. I think the judge in America who is most afraid of what's going to happen is Judge Chutkan. And she's going to have the job of somehow parsing through this. It's going to be very bad precedent, kind of thing that down the road, hopefully going to be visited by another court, but I think it's going to be messy.
And where the rubber meets the road is this Trump leaning on the vice president, Mike Pence.
Absolutely.
Because his lawyers are saying, well, that's official capacity.
Right.
Mike Pence is president of the Senate. That's his official capacity. I'm the president. I'm talking to my vice president. That's official.
But
clearly he was twisting his arm almost to the breaking point to have him commit a crime.
Right. And doing something in your official capacity to accomplish a personal end, which is staying in power, if you will. He reaches out to the Department of Justice, right? We've got all those allegations inside this indictment as well, saying, I want you basically to issue letters to states around the country, including Georgia, telling that there's a problem here. Okay, you can direct your attorney general to do various things, should not be case specific. What you can't do is encourage the attorney general of the United States of America to issue false statements about what's going on. That's a different kind of thing. And again, maybe Tanya Chutkan can parse through that, but it's something we do not have to do. And again, I'm largely hopeful that maybe brighter minds will take hold, and maybe there's some clerks that are convincing them that they shouldn't go down this road, and we'll get a decent opinion. I don't think so, however.
I mean, the justices were either being disingenuous or naive or duplicitous when they were going down this road. I remember Justice Amy Coney Barrett saying, well, Jack Smith, if you want a speedy trial, why don't you just stipulate what's official and what's not official and go to town.
Right. Parse out, Jack Smith, those things that you think are not properly crimes and those things that you think are, and figure out those things. And as Michael Dreeben said, it's an integrated conspiracy. That's the word phrase he used. He got it just right. When you read that indictment, again, in the midst of the oral argument, you can't do what Amy Coney Barrett was describing. You can't say, well, this portion of the second count, that kind of partakes of something personal, and that's you just can't do that. And that was the point he was making. Again, if they do issue some opinion defining the difference between these two things, that in of itself changes the Constitution, if you will. It basically says there are things that a person who is elected president of the United States of America can do. As long as you label them official in nature, we'll give you a pass on those. And that is stunning, right? Even to say out loud.
There is a person above the law. That's the president of the United States, or the former president of the United States.
Right. It is so dramatic as to be unbelievable. And again, I know that this sounds, as I said before, sort of like hyperbole. But if you think about all kinds of things, I used the pardon example before. You use the overseas the enforcement power as the commander in chief. All kinds of things. Where if you order again. Things that are the subject of consultation as a part of enforcing our what we need to do. If you order criminal acts, I need you to go and assassinate the prime minister of name your country, because that person is no longer in my side on view of things. There, that's a difference, right? That's a different kind of thing. How you do that, how you parse through those things, cannot imagine. But we're going to find out, presumably, as you said, Matt, in probably just a few days.
Or as Brian Kelly, the engineer here, was saying, you know, what if you tell the military to go apprehend your opponent?
Right. Exactly. Or, you know, all these kinds of things. It does not have to be overseas. It can be domestic. Right. And, you know, Trump himself has used the expression in previous campaign, I could stand in Times Square and kill somebody. We didn't laugh. We never laugh at that kind of thing. But we all said, well, that is hyperbole. Now we're beginning to think, gee, if you can accomplish that through some other means, Is the Supreme Court going to sanction that? Is that what we're doing, members of the Supreme Court? Please tell us no. Please tell us that's not the circumstance that we've gotten ourselves into.
Yeah, that's what immunity would really mean, or as you put it, impunity,
right,
which is
right.
A word that's often used in Latin America right. for when dictators come to power and do all sorts of atrocities and never are brought to justice. Exactly. I hope we're not going down that road.
Absolutely.
Jim Santel has been my guest this last half hour. He is the host of Amicus on the Civic Media Radio Network. You've been listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Matt Rothschild, subbing in for Maggie today. I want to thank Maggie for having the confidence to let me get behind this mic. And I want to thank Brian Kelly, the Drew Holiday of the Civic Media Radio Network. Everybody have a nice day. Be careful tonight during the storm. Take care.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?